So we are in Psalm 96 today. Actually, just a little preface, we're going to be in another psalm too in the next hour. I'm going to preach Psalm 97. And I think I've worked it out mathematically that by the end of the month we'll make it to Psalm 100, which is, these are all psalms that go together. But for this session, we're going to be in Psalm 96. So let's listen to the Word. Sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord, all the earth. Sing to the Lord. Bless His name. Proclaim good tidings of His salvation from day to day. Tell of His glory among the nations, His wonderful deeds among all the peoples. For great is the Lord and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods. For all the gods of the peoples are idols. But the Lord made the heavens. Splendor and majesty are before Him. Strength and beauty are in His sanctuary. Ascribe to the Lord, O families of the peoples. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory of His name. Bring an offering and come into His courts. Worship the Lord in holy attire. Tremble before Him, all the earth. Say among the nations, the Lord reigns. Indeed, the world is firmly established. It will not be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity. Let the heavens be glad, and let the earth rejoice. Let the sea roar and all it contains. Let the field exult and all that is in it. Then all the trees of the forest will sing for joy before the Lord, for He is coming. For He is coming to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in His faithfulness. God add blessing to the reading and now to the study of His Word. It is hard to not smile when you read this psalm, isn't it? It is so full of joy. This is a favorite amongst many people. So let's talk about what kind of psalm this is. This is, your handout tells you, a hymn for the divine King. This is a classic example of that. Of course, there's a series of these that run together from 93 to 100, and this is one of the gems. There are others, hymns about the divine King elsewhere in Psalms also. The part here that most clearly refers to Yahweh being King, you see it there in verse 10, say among the nations, the Lord reigns. That is what we call a shout of acclamation, where the crowd is acclaiming that the Lord is the King. That's in one of the central verses. Verse 10 is one of the longest verses, one of the dominant verses in this psalm. And so this psalm is so, what can we say about the setting of this psalm? Now, there's a spot there for author, and you notice that there is no verse zero. There is no heading. But this poem is one that we know from other passages is written by David. And we're going to see where that comes from. Now, I almost want to say David and others, because it's possible that there was an editor, an inspired editor, who, besides David. It's an orphan psalm because there's no author that's listed, but I want you to turn back to 1 Chronicles 16. Keep your spot here in Psalm 96. Turn back to 1 Chronicles 16. This is the chapter that tells the story of David's bringing the ark to Jerusalem and making Jerusalem the religious capital. So this is one of the great accomplishments of David's career, is to unite the political capital and the religious capital in the one place. The tabernacle suffered terribly before David. Remember that the Philistines took the ark, and Saul was a terrible king in terms of sponsoring the priesthood. So David is restoring the tabernacle. He's bringing it to Jerusalem. And look with me now at verse 7. Then on that day, David first assigned Asaph and his relatives to give thanks to the Lord. And then we have, oh, give thanks to the Lord, call upon His name, make known His deed among the peoples. This is a psalm that starts here. And I want you to skip now to verse 23. Sing to the Lord, all the earth. Proclaim good tidings of his salvation from day to day. Tell of his glory among the nations, his wonderful deeds among the peoples. For great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised. He's also to be feared above all gods. And it goes on and on, down to verse 33. It's the same as Psalm 96, mostly. There's a few differences. Psalm 96 is a little longer. This is the original poem here. And it looks like later on, this long poem in 1 Chronicles 16 was divided into different parts, and those were made into different songs. So what you have in 1 Chronicles is the original poem, and what we have in Psalm 96 is an edited version of the same thing. So originally, the majority of the poem was penned by David, and then Psalm 96 is a later version of parts of this. And I'll show you some more that other things here in 1 Chronicles 16 where those are found in the Psalms as well. So either David edited this part of the poem and made it a little bit bigger, or someone else did, and whose name is not given. But David is the originator of most of the lines in Psalm 96. And the background to this poem, well, we already said it's for the dedication of sanctuary worship at Jerusalem. The sanctuary was being reset up. It had been sort of operating for a time at the home of Obed-Edom, but things were not really as they ought to be. So the story is told twice. It's told here in 1 Chronicles 16. It's told also in 2 Samuel, verse 6. David's moving the ark to Jerusalem as combining the capitals is really one of his biggest achievements. It's almost the high point of his time as king. It's about 7 years into his reign. So David comes to the throne around the year 1010 BC. And where is it that his capital was when he started off? And hint, it's not Jerusalem. Where is his first capital? Do you remember? It's the opposite of Shebron. It's Hebron, that's right. So a bit south of Jerusalem, he was king in Hebron for 7.5 years. And then in 1003, he moved the capital to Jerusalem. Actually, he conquers Jerusalem and moves his capital there. And in that same year, he brings the Ark of the Covenant there. And there are a number of psalms about that event. And Psalm 96 is one of them. The usage of this poem, the original version in 1 Chronicles 16, was part of a longer song. And if you now flip open your handout, you'll see there's a chart there. It says that at some later time, David or maybe others edited the material, splitting it into different songs. And all of the spin-off songs are orphans. That is, we don't know, there's no name attached to them in the book of Psalms. So you can see there on the original poem, 1 Chronicles 16, verses 8 to 22, that's the same as Psalm 105, verses 1 to 15. Now, Psalm 105 is longer than that. So it looks like, they took part of David's poem and then continued on with it. Psalm 105 doesn't say it's by David. At least the opening part is. And then the part we're studying today, 1 Chronicles 16, 23 to 33, is the same as Psalm 96. 1 Chronicles 16, 34, that's the same as Psalm 106, verse 1. And then verses 35 and 36 is the same as Psalm 106, 47 to 48. And I won't have us flip back and forth to look at those, but you might enjoy doing that and seeing how this original poem in 1 Chronicles 16 was sort of the mother of at least three other psalms. And then there's some other psalms that borrow language from this also. Psalm 96, verses 7 and 8, is something similar is found in Psalm 29. So can turn back to that real quick. Psalm 29. See how this sounds a little similar to something we read. Psalm 29, verses 1 and 2. Ascribe to the Lord, O sons of the mighty. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Worship the Lord in holy array. Now, it's not identical to Psalm 96, 7 and 8, but it's very similar. And this one, we're told, Psalm 29, is a psalm of David. And then I mentioned that Psalm 106, verse 1, is used, and that same verse shows up again in Psalm 136, verse 1. So the psalms sometimes recycle lines and verses, and sometimes entire psalms. That verse is, "Give thanks to the Lord, for He is good, for His loving kindness is everlasting." There is a Jewish tradition that says that Psalm 96 was used when the Second Temple was dedicated. You know that the original version was when the first tabernacle was in Jerusalem was dedicated, and then in the days of Zerubbabel that Psalm 96 was used. Possibly, we can't say for certain, but it's an interesting idea. Back to Psalm 96 and about its place with these other poems. We've already shared how Psalms 91 to 100, that these are all orphan songs. They don't have a verse zero telling us who wrote them. Psalms 93 to 100 are theocratic psalms, or they are the divine king psalms. They all say something about the Lord being king, not only of Israel, but of all the earth. And there's also an interesting connection between Psalms 95 and 96. In Psalm 95, which we looked at last week, the people are called to worship to the Lord and bow in His presence. Look at Psalm 95, verse 6. "Come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker." But then Psalm 96 is addressed to all the world. Sing, verse 1 of Psalm 96. "Sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth." So there's an invitation to Israel in Psalm 95, and now there's an invitation to the entire world to come into His presence. And then we're going to see also later today, there's Psalms 96 and 97. Both of them are summoning the nations to come before Him. And let me give you a little preview of the next hour. If you look at the end of Psalm 96, the last verse says, "Before the Lord, for He is coming, for He is coming to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in His faithfulness." And Psalm 97 has images about God coming. Like in Psalm 97, clouds, verse 2, "Clouds and thick darkness surround Him. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of His throne. Fire goes before Him and burns up His adversaries." So Psalm 96, 97 were written at different times for different events, but they've been placed together because if you're reading from one to the next, the end of Psalm 96 prepares you for some of the imagery that shows up in Psalm 97. All right, back to Psalm 96, and what can we say about the structure of this really joyful poem? Well, one thing that this psalm does is it alternates, it switches back and forth between invitations to worship and reasons why you should worship. It alternates between calling the world to worship with reasons why God should be praised. So verses 1 to 3 are all invitation. And then verses 4 to 6 are reasons why they should do that. You can even see it there and look at verse 4. "For great is the Lord and greatly to be praised." Why should we do this? Because, and verses 4, 5, and 6 are all explaining why the whole world should praise Him. Verses 7 to 9 are invitations. "Ascribe to the Lord, O families of the peoples, ascribe to the Lord." That goes for three verses. And then verse 10, here's the reason. "Say among the nations, the Lord reigns." That's why the nations ought to come before Him. He's the King of all. And verses 11 and 12 are invitations. "Let the nations be glad," you know, followed by reasons for that in verse 13. "For He is coming. He is coming to judge the earth." So there's a very orderly structure. Calls to praise and cause for that praise. Calls to praise and cause for that praise. Calls and then cause. That's a cycle that happens three times. Something else that we see in this psalm is that in verses 1 to 3 and 4 to 6 and 7 and 8 and 8 to 9, they each of them have triplicated statements. Triplicated statements. You know, things like "sing" is going to be mentioned three times in verses 1 to 3. And "ascribe to the Lord" is mentioned three times in the middle of the psalm. And then in the middle of verse 8 through verse 10, there's three commands. Bring an offering. Worship the Lord. Tremble before Him. So this triple pattern is very strong in Psalm 96. Verse 10 is the key verse that asserts that the Lord is the King. And it actually breaks the rhythm. You know, there's been all this three stuff going on, and all of a sudden, here's one verse that just stands out by itself. And because it sort of stands out, it doesn't fit with the flow of it. There's, if you look at different outlines, they different people try to squeeze verse 10 in a different ways. Okay, go to the next page, and we'll make some notes and observations before we walk through verse by verse. One thing that's obvious in this is that there are global appeals. How many times are there references to all the earth and the world? This is a song that reaches out to the nations. It makes worldwide appeal for all men to turn to the Lord in worship and in joy. I don't think we can call this a great commission. It's not like the Israelites are supposed to go to the nations. The vision is almost more that the nations are going to come to them. But this idea that Israel has a role in speaking to the nations and attracting the nations to their God does lay the groundwork for the great commission of Jesus. I'm going to draw a really bad map for a moment, and I have to erase it because I'm out of space. That's the Mediterranean Sea. And that's the Nile. You believe this? Okay. And then here is the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. And so here's Israel. And up here is Babylon. Down here is Egypt. And here are the Hittites. And over there are the Greeks and the Romans. If you're in Babylon and you went to get to Egypt, how do you get there? You do not go that way because that's desert. So if you want to go from Asia to Africa, you must go through Israel. If you want to go from Asia Minor to Egypt, you must go through Israel, and vice versa. Israel is a crossroads. There were highways that ran north and south through it that the world trafficked through. So God strategically puts Israel in this land in part that they might be a witness to the nations who are trafficking up and down through their roads. So Israel is not given a mission to go to the nations, but the nations are coming through their way, and they ought to be able to see something of the greatness of God and spread the word as they go round about. So there's a sense of global appeal through Psalm 96. Letter B, there's a lot of intentional artistry in Psalm 96. It's a very artfully composed poem. There's a lot of thoughtful repetition and word counts. We already mentioned how there's a lot of triplets, you know, sing, 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 ascribe, 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 worship, bow down, so forth. But in addition to that, there's also a number of sevens. For instance, there are, in verses 1 through 10, there are 14 commands, so that's 7 divided by 2. There are 7 references to the nations, or peoples, and there are 7 instances of all, like all the earth, all the peoples. And that is intentional. This is part of the artistry of the psalm. This psalm is also, let me make some space here, it's a little bit insulting, but in a good way. This psalm is insulting to idols in a few spots. Don't worry, their feelings aren't hurt, but look at verse 5. Look at verse 5. For all the gods of the peoples are idols, but the Lord made the heavens. Well, you say, well, that doesn't seem so insulting. Well, the word, see, the Hebrew has a lot of different words for idols, and some of them are words about what the thing is made of, like graven image. You know, that's just tells you it's a piece of wood or metal that's or stone that's been shaped. But this is a very pejorative word. The term for gods is Elohim. That's, you know, kind of general. But then it rhymes with the word for idols, and in Hebrew the word for idols is Elalim. All of the Elohim of the people are Elalim. And Elalim means nothings. It's a very negative word. We've translated it idols to make clear what nothings we're talking about. But they're fake. They're false. There's nothing to them. All of the gods of the peoples are false gods. They're nothing gods. It's not very nice, but it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. And notice then verse 4 ends by saying he is to be feared above all gods. And that's because they're nothings. So there's a bit of rhyme there in verse 5 in that insult. We're going to see later on today, Psalm 97 is going to have something similar to this. Letter D, there is an amazing invitation in Psalm 96. I think it had to have been shocking for some Hebrew people to hear, no less to sing, that Gentiles were in some way welcomed into God's court. In verse 8, look at this. Now, this is speaking to Gentiles. Ascribe to the Lord the glory of his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. Now, the sanctuary grounds were mostly limited to the Hebrews. I mean, the only way a Gentile could come into the courts of the Lord is if they converted. Now, you could come into the outer courts. In fact, in the days of Jesus, there was this large patio and esplanade of, I think it's 30 acres, that was paved, and that was called the Court of the Gentiles. And that's where, if you were a God-fearing Gentile, you could come that far. And you could sing and you could pray, but you couldn't go into the, you know, sanctum itself. And it could be that, but notice that they're bringing an offering. They're supposed to bring an offering. Now, the Hebrew word for offering in this case is not a blood sacrifice. This is a word for a grain offering. In fact, it's not a sin offering at all. It's a free will offering. There are other psalms that talk about nations bringing gifts to God as a king. Let me turn back to Psalm 68. You'll see an example of that. Psalm 68. Verse 29, because of your temple at Jerusalem, kings will bring gifts, literally offerings, to you. And it's the same word that's used here. Psalm 72, verse 10 is another example of this. Let the kings of Tarshish and of the islands bring presents, bring offerings. Often used for grain offerings. And actually, you find elsewhere in the Old Testament that when people came to visit a king, a human king, they would often bring gifts of grain like this. So this is almost more like a political gift. But there's something holy and sacred about this. So this song is paving the way in the minds of the Hebrews for the idea that Gentiles are going to be fully welcomed into God's presence. And it's not laid out how or when, but it's part of the pavement that sets the road for the work of Messiah, and even for, in part, not all of it, but part of it is the church is in line with this vision of the Gentiles coming into God's presence. There's much more in the age to come when Jesus returns. So there's an amazing invitation all throughout Psalm 96. Letter E, this psalm also talks a lot about the joy of creation. Notice how in verses 11 and 12, the inanimate world is called on to rejoice. Let the heavens be glad. Let the earth rejoice. The sea, the field, the trees of the forest. The creation, we're told by the Apostle Paul in Romans 8, is groaning. In one sense, the creation sings. In another sense, creation groans because the world has been subjected to futility. There's a curse on the world. But one day, when Jesus returns, the world will be redeemed. The physical world will be redeemed. And I think that this psalm anticipates the time when the sound of the earth will no longer have any groan. In fact, this song really does look forward, letter F, to the future hope of the world. Now, remember that when David wrote these lines, He was thinking about what God was doing when the ark was brought to Jerusalem, that this was a time of rejoicing. It was something that the whole world ought to take notice of. But notice how the poem ends in verse 13, "For he is coming. He is coming to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in faithfulness." That didn't happen in David's day. There were instances of it. I suppose David's winning battles against the nations was a part of that. But you didn't see the global empire fulfilled. So even David, at his high point, has a vision that God is going to do something more. And it, as Scripture unfolds, we see it is through David's son that the fullness of the kingdom will come. And now we know from the New Testament very clearly it is what will be in the second coming of his son that the fullness of the kingdom on earth will be expressed. All right, go to the back page and we'll walk through the psalm verse by verse through the with the visual outline. Up at the top, there's a purpose statement. It says that the psalmist calls on the world of men and nature to acclaim the surpassing excellence of Yahweh as king. He will come one day to judge the nations and solidify a worldwide realm renowned for justice and joy. Over on the right side, I'll just note that the date, it was originally written in 1003, as we saw in 1 Chronicles 16. It seems to have been reset as an independent song sometime later. We can't say when. Now, come down into the body of the poem, you'll see that there's three summons to praise in verses 1 to 6, 7 to 10, and 11 to 13. Let's look at the one over on the right, the first summons to praise. And these verses focus on how Yahweh is the wonder of the world. The world is summoned to praise him in verses 1 to 3 with a threefold call for the world to sing praise to Yahweh. Look again at verses 1 and the beginning of 2. "Sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth. Sing to the Lord. Bless his name." So there's our threefold command to sing. The reference to a new song doesn't necessarily require a brand new song. Obviously, when this song was written, it was new, but we're still singing it. We're still reading it. There's nothing wrong with using older songs. But the idea is to have new causes for singing and praise, that a renewal of our worship. Oftentimes this word new is used to describe things that have been renewed. Now, we do need new, brand new music. The church should be composing new music because that demonstrates how the faith is fresh and alive and generating new hope. We also need old music to remind us that the faith is old and has roots and runs deep. In one sense, the newness of the song here is not so much the song as it is the people who are singing it. The nations are called, for them, singing about Yahweh is going to be a totally new song. So there's three commands to sing, and then after that, in verses 2 to 3, there's a threefold command to announce Yahweh's deeds to the world. Bless his name. Proclaim tidings of his salvation from day to day. Tell of his glory among the nations, his wonderful deeds among all the peoples. So there's those three commands: bless, proclaim, and tell. So again, Israel didn't have a mission to go to the nations, but they would have an opportunity to speak with people of the nations. And they are called to speak well of the Lord and to tell them that the Lord is the one true king. He's not just their God, he's the God of all the world. We come to verses 4 through 6, and now here's the basis of this summons. Firstly, it's Yahweh's superiority over all gods of the peoples in verses 4 to 5. Look at verse 5. "For great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods." Now, peoples of the ancient world, of course, they believed in many different gods. The Egyptians had oodles of them and temples to this one and that one and the other one. And it was always sort of a gamble to know which god you needed to appease or please. This verse says, you know, done with all of that nonsense. God is above all of it. And the next verse makes clear, the psalmist, David, isn't thinking that those gods really do exist and they're just lower on the totem pole. Because the next verse says, for all the gods, all the Elohim of the people are Elohim. They're actually nothings. People think they're something, but they're actually nothing. And it doesn't matter how big their temples are. You know, if you went into Egypt in the days of Moses, you would be overwhelmed by the magnificence of the pagan temples. They were enormous. When the Jews were taken away into Babylon, they saw magnificent buildings that were far larger than what Solomon had built. Didn't prove a thing. Even though all of that artistry and gold and stone and went into all of that, in the end, those things were nothings. The Lord is great and greatly to be praised. Even though there's no image of him, even though there's no sight of him, he is the greatest of all. And that's why all the world should praise him. There's no one like him. In fact, at the end of verse 5 says, it is Yahweh who made the heavens. You know, it wasn't Baal. It wasn't, I could list a whole bunch of others. It wasn't any of them. They didn't do a thing. The Lord is the creator. And then verse 6 talks about the incomparable majesty of his chamber. When it's talking about the presence of God, here's David. Now, remember, David writes this in the day when they're moving the ark into Jerusalem and they're going to set the tabernacle up there. And the tabernacle was impressive, beautiful, when it was constructed properly. But he's envisioning here the chamber in heaven of God's throne. It says, splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. He has an incomparable throne room. Everything that the pagans have thought about their gods is just fake, and they make up for it with all of their fancy architecture. But in the presence of God in heaven is an unparalleled place of beauty. So that's why all the nations ought to sing to the Lord and rejoice before him. So that's the first summons to praise in verses 1 through 6. Now let's move to the middle of the poem, verses 7 through 10. Here's the second summons. And the thought in these verses is that Yahweh is the sovereign of the world. In verses 7 and 9, the world is summoned to praise. There's again a threefold call for the peoples to acknowledge Yahweh's glory. Look at verse 7. Ascribe to the Lord, O families of the peoples. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory of his name. You kind of feel this sense of climax as I'm reading that. This is actually called climactic poetry because the first line, do this, you people, but I'm not even going to tell you yet what to do. Ascribe to the Lord, and there's no object. Ascribe what? We got to wait to the next line. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength, and then an even bigger line. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due to his name. The families of the peoples. This is the many different, not only the nations, but the tribes amongst the nations. All the people groups of the world are told to recognize how glorious in God is. To ascribe to him is for them to confess that he is glorious and beautiful and magnificent, and there's no one like him. These words, you remember we saw that they are similar to something found in Psalm 29. In Psalm 29, though, David is speaking to spiritual beings, spirit beings. He calls them in Psalm 29, he says, ascribe to the Lord, O sons of the mighty. And he's referring to angelic beings. So here the wording is changed now to refer to people around the world. After that, in the middle of verse 8, in the verse 9, there's three more commands. A threefold command to approach Yahweh in humble worship. The middle of verse 8, bring an offering and come into his courts. Worship the Lord in holy attire. Tremble before him all the earth. It's been a long debate as to what the holy attire is referring to in verse 9. And the question is, okay, are we telling the Gentiles when they come to the outer court that they need to be dressed well? Are we saying, is it saying that they need to be dressed like priests? Or is it not about what the people are wearing? Is it about the way God appears? Is it that Yahweh is as if he's dressed in a magnificent royal priestly garment? Is it about his God's splendor as opposed to our splendor. It is true, you know, that the Israelites, when they came to the sanctuary, they had to dress appropriately. The priests had a uniform, and the people were expected to dress reasonably because they were coming before God. But it may well be that the focus here is about the Lord is in this splendor. And because he's in this magnificent splendor, then the earth trembles before him when they recognize his majesty and his glory. So I won't use this verse to say you can't wear flip-flops to church, but maybe don't do that. That's just my opinion. All right. Now look at the summons for the basis for the summons in verse 10. There's the revelation of Yahweh's reign. Say among the nations, the Lord reigns. This is part of the message. This is the shout of acclamation. Let the whole world know he is the king. And then after that is a threefold effect of his reigning. Look at the end of verse 10. Indeed, the world is firmly established. Number one, it will not be moved. Number two, he will judge the peoples with equity. So because the Lord reigns, the world doesn't fall apart. And we're not talking about the physical world so much as it is the world of humanity. Now, sin has made a mess of the world of humanity, and there are places that are bad, but it's still, you know, we haven't nuked everyone yet. and the world is not going to dissolve until the Lord brings it to its appointed end. And I don't mean by that in terms of public policy we should be careless and, you know, just leave our nukes hanging out here and there. You know, it's not, I'm not saying to be, that would be foolish. We could really mess up one another pretty badly, you know. But the world is not going to dissolve until the Lord ordains the new heavens and the new earth. And before all that happens, the Lord is going to judge. There is going to be a climactic conclusion to history. The Lord will judge the peoples with equity. So there's a sense in which, notice there's the Lord reigns, he reigns right now, but he is going to do something else. So there's a sense in which God is king, but the world doesn't recognize him as king yet. The world doesn't see him as king yet. And God has not executed all judgment yet. But he will. His kingdom will expand and the recognition of it will grow. Come now to the last segment, verses 11 to 13. Here's the final summons to praise, the third summons. And the theme of these verses is that Yahweh is the righteous judge of the world. A theme that was hinted at the end of verse 10. The creation is now summoned to praise. Notice it's no longer the world of men. It's the physical creation. There's a call to sky, land, and sea in verse 11. Let the heavens, that would be the sky, let the sky be glad. Let the earth rejoice. Let the sea roar and all it contains. Everything you can imagine. Up there, down here, out there. It all belongs to God. And while these things do not have voices, they don't have a mind, they were created to testify to his glory. And there is coming a renewal of the world in which the world will greatly rejoice. Verse 12 continues that there's the field and the forest, well, field and trees and forest. Verse 12, let the field exult and all that is in it, all of the animals, all of the places. Then all of the trees of the forest will sing for joy. Very beautiful poetic imagery of creation being restored in its fullness. They will sing for joy. And actually, verse 13 finishes the sentence there. They will sing for joy before the Lord. And then there's the basis of this summons is the coming climax of Yahweh's justice. And notice how there's these three statements, for he is coming, for he is coming to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in faithfulness. Remember when David penned this, the Ark of the Covenant was coming. There was a procession. It was moving. God was on the move, as it were, through a ritual as he was brought into Zion and the tabernacle was set up there. But as they're watching that site and celebrating that greatly, it triggers this thought that something bigger is going to happen. God, in the end of the age, will be on the move. And he will bring about a kingdom far bigger than anything David or Solomon could ever imagine. Far bigger than anything that the Babylonians could do, or the Greeks could do, or the Romans could do, or the British could do, or the Americans could do. He's coming. And we'll see later on this morning when we come into Psalm 97, there's another poetic description of what happens when God comes and how it's going to be a cause for tremendous joy and celebration. Okay, any comments or questions or anything you'd like to share or ask before we close? Yes, Felix.
And I see people there, you know, with their candles. I said, wow, all this for nothing. It was impressive. And I've been to the church in downtown. And seeing their religiosity.
Yeah. Great expense and great pomp and circumstance. I remember I was reading that and talking about that, I was thinking about my trip to Fiji, and Pramen showed me that there in Lotoka is the largest Hindu temple in the southern hemisphere. And I haven't been in it, but it's magnificent and shiny things all around, and I can only imagine what's like. But in the end, it's nothing, you know. And one thing that was hard for the nations to accept was that even though the Israelites had a big temple and it was beautiful, there was no idol to look at. You know, it just shocked them that who are you talking to? Who are you praying to? He's not there, you know. In fact, when General Titus went into the temple to destroy it in 70 A.D., He reportedly was shocked that when he went in the Holy of Holies, there was nothing there. Because he couldn't imagine that you would have an inner sanctum with nothing. But, you know, our God is not made by human hands. And though he cannot be seen by the eye, he is great and greatly to be praised. All right, let's was there another question or comment afterward? Yes, that's right. Yeah. And Psalm 95, yeah, is directly, yeah, is particularly, you know, like Psalm 95, verse 7, we are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand. You know, that's not something that the Canaanites could say. But Psalm 96 is if to say, you too can become attached to the people of God. Well, let's have prayer together. Lord, thank you for this joyful psalm. We thank you that we have learned to sing your praise, to recognize your worth and your glory. It's because the gospel has come to us and has illuminated our understanding that you are a great God and a gracious God who has sent his Son into the world, and you are drawing people from among the nations to proclaim your praise. So with thankful hearts for what you've done, we give to you our gifts of praise, and we ask for your help now as we meet with the church family in the chapel and lift your name on high. To you be much praise. In Jesus' name, amen.